This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. I am very pleased to have with us Joel Dyer to talk about the perpetual prisoner machine. Joel, are you there?
You bet I am, Mike.
Well, great. I'm really glad that you were able to be with us today because, I mean, this is a tremendously important and I think always timely topic as well, because we are now quickly, if we haven't already, reached the point where here in the United States we're incarcerating some 2 million of our own citizens and probably are getting pretty close to being the number one country in this dubious statistic. Is that pretty close to being correct?
Yeah, it's real close, Mike. We're the estimates are, depending on where you get your stats, the low end's about 1.8 million, the high end's right at 2, for how many people are in our prisons and jails. And as far as where we rank in the world, we've just come through the largest prison expansion in history. We've gone in 29 years from 200,000 people to 2 million. Roughly. And that's, I mean, for a matter of perspective, that's 500,000 more than communist China in prisons. There are still a couple of places that show the Soviet Union to be almost in a dead heat with the United States as far as prisoners, and a couple of others that show us to have passed them, probably depending on whether you look at the 1.8 or the 2 million number. So the Soviet Union's our only real competition in the world for prisoners. And you know, when you consider how we've always viewed the systems, you know, in China and Russia, I'm not sure that's a really good thing. You know, I think that our tendency, you know, we're not a country that really looks back at our history a lot for perspective, and so however we are today, we tend to think it's always been this way, but nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to the our incarceration numbers. We have tripled the prison population just since 1980, and I mean, you're talking about humanity, you're talking about adding, you know, 1.5 million people just since that time, to a level that's basically 10 times what it was just 29 years ago. And you know, as far as the percentage of the population, we had a very stable prison population from the turn of the century forward. It wasn't like it's always been growing at this rate. It's really been about the same percentage of how many people per 100,000 were in our prison systems. And then here comes late 70s, early 80s, on through the 80s and now 90s, where it just goes turned straight uphill on the chart and to a, you know, the kind of incarceration we've never seen before, which is really why I wanted to write the book. I mean, there had to be some explanation for why this sudden historical turn in our rates of incarceration, particularly at a time that all of the factors that have previously in our first couple of hundred years of existence have always governed the size of the prison population, all of those forces point that we should now be in a declining prison population, well, not an increasing prison population.
If we look at the statistics on crime, crime is either stagnant or going down at the same time that we have this absolute rise in the prison population. I mean, the statistics don't match, correct?
Correct. Everything about it is topsy-turvy. In one sense, maybe the biggest factors that don't make sense is every time in our past when we had a booming economy, which they tell us now, of course, we're at the end of 8 years of unparalleled, you know, boom in our economy. Well, whenever the economy was really doing well, we've always had a shrinking crime rate and shrinking incarceration rate. They go hand in hand. People who can get a job, you know, no matter how lousy it is at the bottom of the scale, they'll tend to get a job, and then they don't, you know, need to be stealing or don't, you know, face the temptation to become, you know, part of a life of crime. Well, we have the two things working. We have this supposed booming economy, which is, you know, even though it's creating, you know, a lot of lousy minimum wage or part-time jobs, it's still creating jobs for people in the lower part of the economy, and we have the corresponding declining crime rate that usually goes with that economy. What doesn't make sense is this incarceration rate. The rest of it is working as it should. The crime rate tends to, you know, be very influenced by the economy. But the crime rate's been falling, you know, depending on who you talk to, you know, it's been falling anywhere from 1983 to 1991. I say that a little backwards. The Census Bureau says it's been falling since 83. The FBI and the their measure says that it's been falling since 91. But everyone agrees that it's been falling for at least, you know, basically a decade. But still, here we have this incarceration rate. And the mistake most people make is they say, well, of course the crime rate's falling because we've put more crooks in prison.
You know, I'm thinking about so many things. Go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, what I was going to say is that if you talk to, you know, the vast, vast majority of criminologists, they will not tell you that the crime rate is declining because of the increasing incarceration rate. There is virtually no data whatsoever that supports that theory. The only place you hear that theory from is law enforcement and corrections, who both have a great deal of, you know, finances vested in our war on crime. But the real reasons that crime is falling is because of the economy and because of the aging of the baby boomer generation. Most crime is committed by people between the ages, you know, in their teens and early 20s. So with a giant generation like the baby boomers, when we were in that stage of our life, which would have been in the 60s and 70s, basically, we saw an increase in crime. As we matured out of it, we see a decrease in crime. So, you know, that's a very fundamental reason why we have the decrease in crime, as well as the crack cocaine subculture is dying out greatly, and a lot of the crime that went along with that is disappearing. Perfect example, Canada has not done with their prison system what the U.S. did as far as, you know, this massive increase. They barely increased their prison system at all since during the 1990s, whereas we have more than doubled ours, yet they've experienced basically the identical fall in crime rates that we have. So it tells you it's not the number of people going to prison, it's the other factors. And as far as the people, you know, going to prison, most criminologists will tell you that because prison tends to be a violent place where you have to be committing crime while you're in there, joining gangs, doing things like that, just to survive and not be sexually and physically abused on a daily basis, most people come out of prison more inclined to commit crimes than when they went in. So it's very likely that our use of prisons for nonviolent, non-serious offenders, such as drug offenders, has really kept the crime rate from falling as far as it would have had we not done that.
We're talking with Joel Dyer, author of The Perpetual Prisoner Machine. Joel, I want to talk to you about vested interests, because, of course, a lot of what fuels the perpetual prisoner machine, just looking at the cover, tells a lot. And, of course, it's about money. Let's talk about some of the various vested interests that fuel this machine.
Basically, as I've written over this issue for the last decade, I found that there were three categories where crime is currently being exploited for gain. And at first, they seem to be rather unconnected, but the reality is that they're completely connected, and I think account for the vast majority of this unprecedented rise in our prison population. And if people will bear with me, it may seem a little distant at first, but it'll make sense in a moment. But the first one I want to touch on is the media. Being a journalist myself, I know full well how it works, and it's broken right now. And the point I'm trying to make is that the media now uses sensationalized violent crimes to increase their viewership, which increases the ad revenue, which increases their profits to a degree that has never been experienced before. And it really started in the 80s. Now, we have always sensationalized certain crimes. Yes, did we overcover the Lindbergh baby kidnapping? Well, of course we did. But we didn't cover it for, here's an example, Columbine school shooting. It was still on the front page of my daily paper last week. You're talking about 9 months, and we're still being, you know, completely inundated with stories like this. But even cheaper, less important stories. I read so far in December and January this year, I've read about the Joey Buttafuoco Fisher fiasco.
Right.
It's still in the news a half a decade after it occurred. We're still getting updates on John Wayne Bobbitt and his severed penis. We're still getting, you know, the OJ stuff. We're still getting the Menendez brothers. You know, it goes on and on and on. And these are the type of sensationalized things. that it doesn't just seem that we're getting more coverage like that. We are. If you look at what's happened just between 1990 and 1993, the three network nightly news programs on a national level tripled the amount of violent crimes that they covered on the national news. That was at a time when violent crime was decreasing. Why are the networks tripling their coverage at the same time crime is going down? Since then, it's almost tripled again. So we're seeing almost, you know, a half a dozen to a dozen times as much violent crime represented by our news programming as we did 15 to 20 years ago. And it's at a time when crime's going down. Well, since most of us base our understanding of crime and our the risk it is to us on television, particularly our news programs, it makes perfect sense that when we poll America, we find that 80% of the people in the United States believe crime is worse now than it was 20 years ago, and that they are, you know, more in danger of it, and that it's a more serious problem than anything else in the country.
And if national news is bad, I mean, local television is
even
worse. Local
television blows that out of the water, and then you've got, we aren't even touching on the entertainment side, which I talk about in the book. There's a number of psychological reasons why entertainment violence on TV also affects our fear of crime, because after a short period of time, we don't remember where we saw something. It all blends together. It's like, well, was that mad killer on the news, or was it on, you know, this show over here? We don't remember. We just remember the violence. And in the 1990s, the violence on entertainment television has gone up 70%. 70%. You know, so we're being inundated with more violence through television than ever before. Now, most people, when they study this, they study, well, does that make us become violent? You know, I saw natural-born killers, and I went out and committed a crime. That is a very small percentage. That's really, you know, not what we should be the most concerned with. What we should be concerned with are the studies that come back and show that over, you know, nearly half of the entire population of the United States believes that it's unsafe for us to walk in our own neighborhoods at dark. 80% of us, when polled, rate crime as the most important issue facing our nation. Now, we have this exaggerated fear and anxiety and concern over crime at a time when we're safer than we were 20 years ago. Crime is lower. Everything's really doing pretty good. Most of us, you know, aren't really that much in danger. But we have that feeling. Well, now we go to the second part of the machine. Think of that as the media gear of the machine. And again, it's all being driven by the consolidation of the media. You know, as we see that, you know, nine companies now control over half of the media in the world, those companies want their newsrooms to produce profit just as much as, you know, their entertainment side. So in essence, Murphy Brown's newsroom is very similar to Dan Rather's. The parent company wants both of them to make a profit. And the truth is, when you and I are faced with watching one news channel that has campaign finance reform on it and another news channel that has a former nude dancer who was murdered with a ferret and a pickaxe, we tune in to the sensationalized murder. And because the parent companies, you know, GE's, Time Warner's, Disney's, they know that. And so their newsrooms now incorporate a great deal of the sensational, but altogether meaningless as far as informing the electorate, crimes. And that's what we're fed. And it's certainly partially our fault, because we would, you know, we would turn into another station if, you know, if given the choice. But now what happens with the increasing importance of the political consultants, which politicians are the second gear of the machine, the perpetual prisoner machine. The rise of the political consultants really started with advancements in technology at the end of the 70s and certainly into the 80s. We now, instead of having a consultant go to work for a politician in Washington in the last 6 months of their campaign just to help them tinker with things and maybe get elected, we now have consultants like Dick Morris and people like that that are hired on all through the campaign. They remain on staff after the election and help politicians shape the way that they act once they're in office so they can be reelected the next time around. That's why campaigns used to cost $200,000, now they cost $10 million. A lot of it is all the polling and consultants.
So
now these consultants run their polls, and they say, gosh, 80% of the population's terrified of crime. And so they tell their candidate to go out there and be harder on crime, because that will get him elected. And if you try to be reasonable and say, we can't afford to do this, this is all, you know, we shouldn't be this afraid, there's nothing to justify it, you become Michael Dukakis, 1988, you're slammed with the soft on crime label because of the Willie Horton ads, you can't be elected. So almost every candidate at every level of politics since 1988 has taken a hard on crime stance because their pollsters tell them it's the best way to get elected.
It's very interesting because I remember reading a story. I cannot remember who the Supreme Court justice was, but it was a state Supreme Court. And he basically said in the state, these Supreme Court justices were elected. And he was saying, I quit because I cannot stake out a rational position, in particular in this case was about the death penalty. Right. And so I have to get elected, I have to be for the death penalty. I'm not necessarily always for it. So in order to play the electoral game, I have to do something that I don't really believe in. And I'm not going to do that. So in his case, he quit. But what I'm hearing you say is that these pollsters feed off the fear of the public and then tell the politicians, look, you better, if you want to get elected, you better do this stuff, and then they do.
It's exactly correct. And what you're saying with judges, it's unbelievable. In the Boston Law Review, and I cited in my book, I believe that is exactly where it was published, but they did a study that was, I mean, it's just make you sick to your stomach. What they found was that in states where judges have to stand for election, that in the 6 months prior to election, they put forward so many more death penalty decisions right. than they do the rest of the year. Clearly geared to pleasing the public, they actually sentence men and women to die in order to better their chances of being elected. And the study found that to be uniform across the board. And also what you're saying that I think is really important is the judge you were talking about step down. That's what's happened in our political spectrum. People who know what the right thing to do, but realize that to do it would probably mean they can't get elected, have stepped down. And it's created this new sort of political process which weeds out the people who would take a more reasonable, more fiscally responsible, and I believe morally responsible position on crime in prisons. And they are basically weeded out of the system to the point where, I mean, you look at the last presidential election, you had Bill Clinton and Bob Dole standing in San Diego arguing about who was harder on crime, and Bill Clinton won.
Right.
The Democrat was slightly to the right of the Republican. That's the world we've created, and which also comes from a politician like Bill Clinton that, you know, his own pollster, Dick Morris, in his writings says Bill Clinton polls as often as he breathes. The man polled about where to vacation, what tie to wear, what words to use. It's devastating. I mean, we're letting the public, and some people believe this is democracy, and this is, you know, where it gets very scary. We're letting the general public, who knows nothing about the realities of the statistics of prison, the amount of money that's being spent, how it's depleting their own education systems and mental health care and all these things that are now being poured into prisons, that public who's 80% of is afraid of crime is basically the reason that we're creating the prison system that we are. But as opposed to that being, that's democratic. If 80% of us are afraid, then this is a good system. We have to ask why they're afraid.
Right.
And they're not afraid because, you know, where did their opinion come from? It didn't come from when they walk out their front door in the morning. What do they see? I mean, are people being stabbed on the street? You know, no. But when they look in the out the window of their television in their living room, that is what they see. So this public opinion has been shaped by the increasing exploitation of crime as a way to enhance revenues by the media, particularly the television media, and as a result, we've created a penal system that would be appropriate for the type of an amount of crime we see on our televisions, not the type and amount of crime that we see in our front yards.
We're talking with Joel Dyer, author of The Perpetual Prisoner Machine. Joel, there's the third gear, which I'm going to assume you're going to talk about, which is the amount of profit that is being made
right.
off of this penal system. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure, and it's very important because none of this could have come to pass. The first two gears would have been rendered unable to do the damage that's been done if it were not for the third gear. And that's why this whole thing becomes a machine that's much more efficient when it's working as a single unit as opposed to these gears on their own. The prison industrial complex, which I describe as, which I describe as a collection of corporations and various entities whose financial profits increase with the size of the prison population. So, private prisons have a vested interest, prison brokerages, telephone companies. I mean, telephone companies make $1 billion a year by charging inmates up to seven times as high rates as what you and I pay. And the families who are taking those collect calls who already have lost their breadwinner basically are being exploited and have to pay for that. But that by itself is a $1 billion industry. Prison construction, a three to even larger $1 billion a year industry. Goldman Sachs, Shearson Lehman, the people that sell non-voter approved bonds, their percentage has become a multi-billion-dollar industry. And then you get into the things like prison labor, where TWA has their reservations being made by, prisoners and Victoria's Secrets using prison labor, and Lexus automobile hood emblems are being made by prison labor, and Spalding golf balls are being packed by prison labor, and Microsoft uses them, and it goes on and on and on to what is, in the next 5 years, going to be an $8 billion a year industry. It's only about a $3 billion a year industry now, prison labor. But what it all adds up to is the criminal justice system has gone from about $6 billion a year to run it to $150 billion. It's expected to go over $200 billion a year by the year 2002. Now, to put that in perspective, our entire defense budget is $290 billion this year, and the prison budget is growing at a rate many times faster. That's the motive behind why all these companies, American Express is building prisons, or funding them. It's incredible. But what's really important here is that these corporations and their participation, when we turned our criminal justice system into a capitalistic experiment, what we did was take off the last binding of democracy that used to keep a giant prison boom like this in check. And I'll explain that. Historically, what happened was the prison system would always grow during a bad time, whenever it was growing, to the point where we ran out of space in our prisons. And at that point, the judges or whoever was deciding on someone going into prison, they had to look at it and say, okay, we don't have any more room in prison, so we need to take our nonviolent offenders, our non-serious offenders, and we'll treat them with probation or drug treatment program, whatever. Treat them for pennies on the dollar outside of prison, which, by the way, just a statistic to throw in, 15 times more effective to treat a person with a drug problem with drug rehab than prison, 15 times more effective. And it costs about somewhere around a tenth of the prison cost. So 15 times more effective for a tenth of the price. But we're not doing that. But anyway, because there's no profit in it. But to go back to where I was, whenever the prison system needed to grow, politicians had to go before the electorate, the general public, and say, we need to pass some bonds to build more prisons. If people passed those bonds, they built the new prisons and more people went to prison. At some point, historically, there have been these cycles where people said, you know what, no more. We're pouring all this money into prisons. It's not making anybody safer. Boom. We're not going to fund any more prisons. And that's when we had to get creative and find other things to do with nonviolent offenders. Well, during the 1980s, some states like New York starting early on in the 80s, but certainly by the end of the 1980s, almost every state that put forward bond issues, whether it's California or New York or Colorado, wherever it was, the electorate voted them down. The electorate said, no, we will not go into more debt, sell more bonds to build more prisons. We won't do it. Well, what that should have done is stop the number of prisons being built. And what that would have done was forced the justice system to take another look at all these mandatory sentences that were being passed on nonviolent offenders. There wouldn't have been anywhere to put them, so it would have caused the kind of whacked-out sentencing structure to be altered. But that didn't happen. That's a function of democracy that should have been there. You and I should have the right to say no to paying for more prisons, which forces the justice system to figure out what to do with nonviolent offenders to make sure that they have enough room for the violent ones. But instead of that happening, this time private corporations from CCA to American Express to Shearson Lehman all stepped forward and said, hey, if the public won't pay for these, we'll put up the money, we'll build the prisons, and you don't have to ask the permission of the taxpayers to divert money out of education to pay us back, or to divert money out of transportation or mental health or welfare aid to children. So you can bypass the electorate. You can basically skip what the voters are saying. We don't want to pay for more prisons. We'll pay for them. You divert the same, actually more, cost 20% more to turn around and pay off these prisons to the private private industry has built and private funding. And so instead of stopping at about 600 new prisons, we've added 500, 600, 700 more beyond that. And so the lid that should have been on, we probably, the taxpayer revolt on paying for prisons should have stopped our prison population at somewhere around 1 million. But it's been able to double because of the fact that corporations are funding the prisons that voters are refusing to fund. California is a perfect example. Your voters said no to $6 billion worth of prisons and floating those bonds. What did, you know, your elected officials do? They simply turned around and issued lease revenue bonds, which cost 20% more than the voter-approved version. And now they're diverting funds from your you know, my gosh, your college system is just being decimated. Your welfare aid to children is being decimated. All that money is going into prisons that the public refused to vote in. Yeah. So basically, democracy no longer has any control over this massive growth of the prison population. That control now rests with politicians who are saying, I'm hard on crime to get elected, and corporations who are saying, and we'll build the facilities to hold the people that you're getting elected by putting in jail.
And not only, of course, that, but these same politicians are dependent upon these same corporations to get campaign money in order to run in the first place.
You're exactly right, Mike. That kind of creates the final loop there, which really gets scary. You have private prison corporations pouring money into campaign coffers. You have your, for instance, your prison guard union in California is well publicized as like been the leading financial contributor to your last two governors.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when they get their access by putting up all of that money, what do you think they say? They say, be harder on crime, be harder on crime. Why? Why do prison guards care? Because their salaries have doubled in the last decade. I mean, your prison guards are now making $55,000 plus benefits. Your teachers aren't it's harder and harder for them to make a living every year, while your prison guards are, you know, they don't even have to have a college education, and they can start driving Lexus. You know, so all these vested interests are basically working to grow the system because all these independent little gears and entities all are doing something to increase their own shareholder revenues. And, you know, it's completely bypassing democracy, and we're going to have 6 million people in jail in just 20 years from now if we don't pull the plug on this thing.
We've been speaking with Joel Dyer, who's the author of The Perpetual Prisoner Machine, and unfortunately, we've only touched on a small part of everything that Joel has put forth in this book. Joel, we're at the end. The clock is dictating. Thank you for joining us today to talk about The Perpetual Prisoner Machine. We'll have you back on in 2 weeks, and perhaps I think we're going to need to have you on at some point in the future to further expand this discussion of our criminal justice system. Thank you very much for being with us.
Love being here, Mike, and you do a great show, and wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.